Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the 286-horsepower TL Type S with a sport-tuned suspension. Learn more at Acura.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Artists have painted it, philosophers have mused over it, theologians have pronounced on it, now doctors are studying it. What happens when we die? In the passage from life to death. Throughout history, we've heard the stories, and we'll hear them this hour firsthand. But could science pin it down, give us a road map, tell us what to really expect? One British doctor is beginning a massive study to find out. This hour on Point, honing in on how the human mind experiences the passage from life to death. Joining us today from New York is Dr. Sam Parnia. He is a fellow in pulmonary and critical care medicine at Cornell University and founder of the Consciousness Research Group at the University of Southampton in the UK. He's currently leading a study in collaboration with a network of hospitals and doctors to investigate scientifically what happens when we die. Dr. Sam Parnia, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Why do you care?
I care for a number of reasons. Firstly, because unfortunately, whether we like it or not, all of us at some point will be confronted with this question of what happens when we die. Firstly, because unfortunately, whether we like it or not, we will lose or have already lost loved ones. And unfortunately, one day we will also come to a point where it's going to be our turn. And unfortunately, from a scientific point of view, we simply don't know what happens when we die. We don't have a science. We have a science around life. We don't have a science of what happens. But from a medical point of view, dealing with life and death is a real part of our lives. It's a daily part of my life and colleagues like myself. And we need to have a science to allow people to understand what happens to them when they die.
Now, your ambitions here do have some modesty. You're not looking at eternity. You're looking at really at the, I don't know, define it for us, the moment or minutes of death itself, sort of the act of dying and that passage or period.
Yes, we're looking essentially at what happens to the human mind and consciousness, as well as the brain, during clinical death. And what we know is that essentially people who are in hospital for various reasons, some of them are very critically ill, and unfortunately they do die. Now, we attempt routinely to bring people back to life. So if somebody's heart stops, if they stop breathing, and as a consequence their brain stops functioning, in other words, they have reached clinical death, this is the definition of clinical death, we will then try to restart the heart, and we call that a cardiac arrest. We try to restart it. Mm. Now, in the majority of people, of course, we're not successful. They have died, and we're not able to bring them back. But we can bring back about maybe 10 to 15% of people who die. And this period in which they've gone through death can be very brief. It may just be a few seconds, but it can last many minutes. And in some occasions, it can last well over an hour. So what they provide us is essentially a unique window through which we can understand what happens to the human mind and consciousness when they have died. And it's essentially what we will all experience. So, and that's the group that we're studying.
And you're putting together a very large experiment to do this, though maybe audaciously you've already written the book last year, What Happens When We Die. So, I mean, what do we know already and what do you hope to further prove and how?
Well, for years now, there have been reports of people who have described very interesting, unusual experiences. This is what we call a near-death experience, where for whatever reason, if they've come close to death, they've had a critical illness or maybe a car accident, they've described feeling very peaceful, feeling very joyous, perhaps seeing a bright light, very warm, welcoming light that takes the person towards them, maybe going into a very beautiful place, perhaps having an instantaneous life review and even seeing deceased relatives. These are some of the main features. More importantly, or the most significant component of what they have described, is a sensation of separating from themselves, floating up to the ceiling, but nevertheless being able to see and recall exactly what had happened during that period. Now, this phenomena has been debated for about 30 years, but it hadn't been studied appropriately through scientific means until the late 90s. And since that time, there have been 5 independent scientific studies published by different groups, one ourselves in the UK, a study that was published from a Dutch group, and also 2 studies in the US and a further one in the UK. And all of these have actually looked at people when they have reached the clinical point of death, in other words, a cardiac arrest. And what they've all concluded is that at least 10 to 20% of people who have reached death and whose brain has stopped functioning appear to have a fully functioning mind and consciousness. In other words, they're able to have lucid, well-structured thought processes, they have reasoning, they have memory formation, and a proportion of them do come back and describe seeing and recalling exactly what had happened to them. Now, this is itself a fascinating finding, but it does need further work to confirm it 100%. And so, in effect, the book that I had written a year ago was essentially describing the science up to that point. And now we're moving further by devising a large multi-center study, hopefully across many countries, including the US, as well as obviously the UK, to once and for all definitively find out what happens when we die.
We're going to look back at history, how people have understood this, and it's really fascinating. We're going to hear firsthand from a man who had that near-death experience and came back with quite a tale. We'll poke at what it means that people come back and recount what they believe or perceive to have experienced. But what about your study itself? How do you intend to sort of nail down what's happening here? Give us some of the nuts and bolts of it.
Well, you see, where people describe the near-death type of experience, in other words, where they feel very peaceful, they describe seeing a bright, warm, welcoming light, perhaps deceased relatives, it's generally a very, very pleasant experience for the individual. And often people find it difficult to describe exactly what they felt because they don't have the right words. But one of the problems is that essentially this experience is very personal to the individual. So those who've had the experience, by and large, the majority of them really believe that they have seen something of an afterlife.
But you're going to try and capture this somehow. You're going to put cameras in cardiac units in hospitals or have tape recorders and people ready to take their stories right away. You know, it sounds like Ghostbusters. How are you going to do it?
Well, this is the key thing. You see, up to that point, these experiences are personal and there's no way that we can verify whether, for example, somebody saw a light. But a proportion of people do come back and they describe the sensation of floating out of themselves, going to the ceiling, looking down, and they'll tell us, they'll say, for example, at 9:20, Dr. Smith walked into the room, he was wearing a pink tie, and as he walked in the room, he tripped over a bucket and he dropped all the instruments and then he swore.
Right.
They describe very specific details that happened on that particular occasion.
When they were supposed to be dead.
When they were exactly clinically dead and being revived.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So the only way that we can sort of verify this is to focus on that component of the experience. And what we have done is, and are continuing to do, I should say, is to place images, targets that are only visible from the ceiling and not from the ground level below. So if a large proportion of people, let's say 200 or 300 people, do claim to have been at the ceiling watching themselves during this time, we would expect them to be able to see these pictures that they would not have known about before and none of the medical or nursing staff would have known about before either.
Now, wait a minute. Let me be sure I understand. This sounds so unbelievably literal. You're going to have some object or image next to the care bed in the cardiac emergency unit. So if someone actually, their mind floated to the ceiling and looked down, they would see it and that will be your test of whether they were floating at the ceiling somehow or not?
Essentially, these are images that are placed above the head of the bed at a height that is out of reach, but near the ceiling. So if somebody is at the ceiling, they should be able to look down and they would be able to see it.
That sounds so unbelievably literal for a medical experiment. I mean, it sounds kind of like, forgive me, but it sounds like hokum. But do you, as a doctor, as a medical, you know, scientist, do you believe that somehow people's minds actually hover up to the ceiling and then turn around and look down on their clinically dead bodies?
Well, at this point, this is the purpose of doing the experiment. Mm-hmm. We don't know exactly what happens. What we certainly have is a large body of anecdotal evidence where people have accurately described what has happened to them. We also have a body of evidence given by physicians who have attended cardiac arrests, who have been completely freaked out by what their patients have then told them once they have been brought back to life. Things that there is no way that they could have known about. So if we want to be completely objective, I think that we have to accept that we simply don't know what is going on, but the only way to know is to test all the possible possibilities. Now, one of these possibilities is that these people are having what's called a false memory. It's just an illusion. Mm. They think they're at the ceiling. They're not lying. They really believe they were there, but it was just a trick of the mind. They weren't really at the ceiling. One other possibility is that perhaps somehow they open their eyes and are able to recall information and then tell us. And the third possibility is that maybe there is something very perplexing going on. In other words, the human mind and consciousness is actually separating from the brain, going to the ceiling and able to look down. Now, this is what they describe.
And it's not just the visual vantage that you're looking at here. You're going to be actually systematically recording the experiences of those 10 or 15% who come back. So you build a kind of a unified body of experience to look back on and draw conclusions from.
Well, we won't be able to record this information for various sort of data protection acts and things like that, in the sense that, you know, with a camera, if you think about it. But we do record it in terms of what happens to the heart. And in many cases, we'll be recording exactly what happens to the brain using brain monitors. Now, these will be obviously anonymous for the purposes of the study. But yes, we'll be recording in detail what's going on there.
Dr. Parnia, let me begin to bring in some of our listeners. Sean is calling from Walcott, Connecticut. Sean, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, how are you?
Very well. What do you know?
Well, I work part-time as a paramedic, and unfortunately I've seen death. You know, I've been doing it for 19 years, and many times I've had patients who have this impending doom and say, I'm going to die.
You mean while they're in the ambulance, while you're taking them?
Yeah, while I'm taking care of them, they have this impending doom. They get very, very scared, saying, I'm going to die. They're screaming, they're flailing. And unfortunately, many times, they do die right in front of me. And it's very unnerving. And I've told my students, in fact, I'm heading right now to talk to students right now, that when they say that, you better be prepared because they are going to die.
So you have a sense from your experience that they have some prescience, that they're not just fearing death, but they actually have, they know that it's headed toward them.
Yeah, they know. For whatever reason, these people, you know, they know, and it's a definitive feeling that they have that they are going to die, and unfortunately many times, I would say 90%+ of the time, they end up on dying in front of me.
No kidding. I can only imagine. You see them very often in an extreme emergency situation with pain and flailing, as you say. Does it look to you like they're headed for, you know, sweet music and bright lights and gentle serenity? And
no. Personally, I think it's what these people have, a feeling that they want to live. I actually had a cancer patient who was going through it, and she said she was going to die. I talked to her, and I said, you're not dying, you have kids, you're not going anywhere. And she told me, she said she saw a light, and she came back because she heard me talking about her children. And I was I was not going to let this girl die on me.
Wow. Sean,
I was doing everything to keep her alive.
Sean, stick with us for a second here. Sam Parnia, a couple things. One, what about this prescience? Sean says his observation is that when people say I'm dying, they're often right.
I think it's an absolutely correct observation. I mean, I had exactly the same thing. I learned this experience in my first year after I qualified for medical school, dealing with patients, and they would tell me, "Look, doctor, I'm going to die tomorrow," and I would say, "Oh, don't be silly." You know, I'd also try and reassure them and think then, you know, I'd try and say no. And there were many cases where really I did not think that they were ill enough to die, and then for whatever reason, they would suddenly have a cardiac arrest and the whole team would be called, and I'd be there and thinking, my God, this guy told me yesterday I'm going to die tomorrow, and here we are tomorrow, and I'm there and I'm trying to save his life and I'm not able to bring him back to life.
And what about the gentle light, the serenity and all of that? Does it matter how people die? I mean, Sean sees people who are, you know, suffering and in pain. Do they have the same shot at that gentle, bright light and all the rest?
What people typically describe is that when they're in that situation, so for example, somebody who's had a heart attack or has had a clot in the lungs, what we call a pulmonary embolus, and they're in intense pain, the chest is really hurting them, they're finding it hard to breathe, they're getting very anxious. What they then say is that as this was going on, then suddenly I felt relieved. I felt I was completely free. I was at the ceiling. I looked down. I saw doctors working on me. I saw paramedics working on me, but I was really comfortable. I didn't want to go back. I was in a very, very peaceful state. And then I saw this very bright, warm, welcoming light that drew me towards itself. Now, in some cases, they will describe having a thought. For example, I then thought of my two young children and thought, well, who's going to take care of those children if I don't go back. And with that thought, I found myself back in my body, back in pain, short of breath and suffering.
Sean, as you head off in the ambulance with people who may be dying, I mean, does it matter to you to know what's really going on there? Do you think it's important? Do you think it's knowable?
Well, you know, for me, it's just become, you know, it's just to me, if they die in front of me, they die in front of me. It just becomes a body. You know what I mean?
Yep.
I don't feel a presence leaving or anything for me. I'm pretty much serene at this point in time. I also work full-time as a firefighter. If I die, I die, you know. And so I've pretty much come to peace where, younger as a child, I was scared. I was really scared to die.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But now I pretty much, you know, have seen so much of it that I've come to the point that, okay, I'm going to die, whatever way that may be. And I've come to the point that, yeah, I will, you know, I'll accept that.
Whatever our consciousness or lack of consciousness of it is. Sean, thank you very much for that. Let's get another from Hilton Head, South Carolina. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My experience was I fell off a three-story building back in 1988.
Ouch.
I landed on concrete and, you know, actually cracked a 4-inch thick concrete slab when I hit.
Ooh.
But I was in the ambulance and I could hear the driver, the paramedic, radio in my injuries into the hospital. I was fully conscious. I knew what was happening. I'd never lost consciousness. But I just started to get this from the bottom of my toes all the way up my legs. I started just a freezing feeling, and everything started going black. And I could hear the paramedic say, "I'm losing them. I'm losing them." And at that point, that was when the peacefulness took over, and I just kind of like relaxed. And next thing I knew, I felt like I left my body, and the top of the ambulance had stopped me from going any further. And I was looking down on myself and the paramedics, and I watched the paramedic reach behind him and grab the shockers, whatever those are, rub them together and hit me with it. He said, "It's not working." And he pushed the other paramedic out of the way and grabbed a needle. Saw him hit me in the chest 3 times hard and then jabbed me with the needle. And at that moment, I went back into my body.
Michael, did you ever think you were actually dead during that time?
I know I was out of my body looking down. I'm not sure if it was energy or consciousness or what you can term it, but I was, you know, if it's out of your body, is dead. According to the paramedics, I had died for a few minutes.
Yep. Michael, thank you very much for sharing that. And there's that out-of-body experience again that Dr. Samparnia is looking to track down. Whether or not you're actually dead there, well, I'm not sure. Let's get another call from Saranac Lake, New York. Kate, you're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
I studied research design at Cornell back in the 90s, and human development, and what we were taught is you could have a painting, for instance, prominently on a wall, and you could have 20 people in that room and question them later about what they saw, and not a single person will have noticed the painting because they weren't attending to it.
Even if they were alive and fully conscious, let alone dead.
Yes, and you know, they just never noticed the painting. It wasn't of interest to them. And this was confirmed to me years later. I've had a lot of heart surgeries, and I've had, unfortunately, half a dozen near-death experiences. And during, my first prominent one, my concern was for my son. And I went down the hallway at Johns Hopkins over gurneys looking for my son. I mean, I was not interested in anything that was in the room. I was looking for my son.
So you're picking up on Samparnia's plan to have an object near at the head of the potential deathbed and saying, who knows if they'll even spot it or see it for what it was.
Who cares? I mean, we don't care about that stuff when we're dying, you know. We care about our loved ones. And I'd also like to know what he thinks of Ian Stevenson at the University of Virginia, his research, because I haven't heard that mentioned.
Good. Thanks very much, Kate. Samparnia, what do you say?
I think that researching this area, really, it's a very novel, it's very new, and nobody's done this in a lot of detail before. We actually tried to do this ourselves many years back as part of a pilot study. But we just have to wait and see. I mean, obviously, we don't expect everyone we don't even know if their mind and consciousness really separates out from the brain, thinking about it objectively, but let's assume for a moment that it really does. Of course, we don't know what they'll be interested in. What I have had is I've had many, many anecdotes. I've interviewed over 500 people, and I've read their accounts as well. And many of them actually do hover around and become kind of interested in this state. They'll look around and they'll say, for example, one lady told me that, you know, I was looking at the hospital. She was a nurse who worked at a hospital herself. And I was thinking, my God, how filthy this place is. How come nobody's dusted this clock? And how come there's a crack on this wall? That
she was clinically dead?
Yes, yes, exactly. During this out-of-body experience, she was there. And once she was comfortable with her surroundings, she started to observe the details of the things around them. And there are others who, you know, like you just mentioned, will be interested in specific things like family members, or maybe even go beyond the ceiling and not even hover around at all. So I think we just have to wait. If we get a large enough sample of people, hopefully we'll have enough people that we can objectively study.
You know, this raises so many questions. I mean, couldn't it be some kind of hallucination, or just some chemical thing that happens at death, or some memory instantly reconstructed once the patient is revived, or a thousand things other than a literal, you know, dead person looking down on themselves?
I think you've raised very interesting points, and I'll try to address them very briefly. Many people have said, well, couldn't this just be a hallucination? The problem that we have from a scientific point of view is that the studies that are now being done during cardiac arrest, in other words, during clinical death, have all demonstrated that essentially by about 10 seconds, brain function ceases. So if you put a monitor on the brain, you cannot detect any more electrical activity of the brain. And this makes sense, because if you think about it, the heart isn't beating, blood isn't flowing into the brain, and therefore the brain cannot function. Now, when we try to revive people by compressing on the chest and shocking the heart, we try to improve that, but we cannot improve it sufficiently to generate electricity within the brain. Now, what we have is a paradox, because here we have a non-functioning brain during clinical death, yet we have 10 to 20% of people who actually have a fully functioning mind, consciousness. They have lucid, well-structured thought processes, they have reasoning, and they have memory formation.
Or appear to have had that when they're revived.
They describe having it. Now, the other problem that we have is that, yes, exactly, when we interview them, the other problem that we have is that these people will come back and describe specific details of what they had seen, which had actually happened if you interview the staff who were present. So if you, for example, talk to somebody like Sean, the paramedic, they will tell you, yes, we did do these things, and what this person is saying is correct. And so you can see that this happened, for example, 20 minutes into the cardiac arrest. And therefore, by definition, it cannot be a hallucination, because he or she is describing a real event. So I think the only conclusion that we can make is that, yes, of course, when someone is dying, there are various chemical changes that take place in the brain. The brain and the body do everything that they can to keep themselves alive. We have the highest levels of epinephrine, various hormones such as steroids being pumped into the body
naturally,
to keep it alive. At some point, this is the biological response, the human response, and we obviously try to give more when we're resuscitating people. What then happens at some point, this triggers the brain, this stimulates different parts of the brain, and the person has what we call a near-death or a death or an actual death experience. And at some point, they describe the sensation that their mind separates from the brain. It may be that what's happening is a bit like a fighter pilot, a jet pilot, who does everything they can when they're in the fighter, and they realize the fighter is about to crash, and they do everything they can to keep it going. But at one point, they realize that they cannot, and they press the eject button, and they eject out of the fighter, and the fighter then crashes and is destroyed.
Let's pause right there for a moment, if you would, because that's a huge line through science and philosophy. I mean, they're implicit in that is that there's some they to pop out of the brain, some consciousness separate from mind. That seems, you say that you're not religious, but that seems kind of, I don't know, retro. We had on a few months ago Patricia and Paul Churchland out at UC San Diego, philosophers of mind, but also of molecular biology, asserting very strongly that science is increasingly saying, look, there's nothing but biochemistry here and molecular biology here. You know, forget Descartes, never mind some, you know, consciousness separate from the brain. It is all about the brain. I mean, what is there to bail out from the brain? Once the brain's dead, what's that thing that bails out?
Well, what you've touched on essentially is the biggest problem in science today, which is, what is the nature of the human self? What is the mind and how does it interact with the brain? There are many scientists out there who believe that the brain somehow generates all our thoughts, everything that makes us into unique individuals as we are. So all our amalgamation of our thoughts, our feelings, our emotions, our sentiments that make us each as unique individuals. The problem that we have from a scientific point of view is that we have no idea how brain cells can possibly generate thoughts. We all interact with our thoughts. Right now, you and I are communicating through our thoughts. But we have no idea how those little gray brain cells, which produce proteins, can also somehow produce this amazing phenomena of thought. So if you were to look down a microscope and examine a brain cell, and if I were to tell you, look, this brain cell is now thinking, I'm hungry or I'm tired, you'd say, well, that's not possible. So then the question is, how, if we connect two of these cells together through a little bit of electricity, do we suddenly have this phenomena of thought?
But are you going from there to a presumption that there's some, you know, in the old version, a soul at work here? I mean, isn't people may believe it, but isn't scientifically that kind of a leap?
Well, this is what I'm trying to explain to you, that I'm just examining all the theories. But what I'm trying to explain is that if you then connect millions of these cells together, we still have a fundamental problem, which is that we cannot explain how the human mind or thoughts come about. So if you were to examine the scientific literature, there are essentially multiple theories that are proposed, but none of which have any scientific evidence that show which of these is correct. There are some who have a theory that it is somehow brain cells that generate it, although we don't know how. And there are others, very notable scientists, Nobel Prize winners, such as Professor Sir John Eccles, who's one of the most renowned neuroscientists of the 20th century, who really believed, in his opinion, that actually no matter what we do, the human mind or consciousness is really separate from the brain, more an opinion that perhaps Descartes had. For the first time ever, we have evidence and means by which we can test these two broad theories. One is that it's simply a brain-based phenomena, and the other being that actually it is a scientific entity, one that we haven't yet discovered, but isn't produced by brain cells. It interacts with the brain cells, but isn't produced by them.
And you think the moment of death may be a promising point at which to investigate that very question?
This is exactly the time that we can do it, because at this point, we have evidence and we can demonstrate the brain stops functioning. So if the views of people who think that this is simply a brain-based phenomenon are correct, there should be no activity of the mind.
We're talking this hour about the experience of death, how the human mind and consciousness experience the passage from life to death, the big crossover. My guest is Dr. Sam Parnia. His book is What Happens When We Die. In just a moment, we're going to get a firsthand account from Jerry Baldwin in Cedartown, Georgia, of his passage. Let's go first to Juanita in Panama City, Florida. Juanita, you're on the air.
Hi. I just had a question. If all this is true, maybe we should, or I should, go ahead and study the Tibetan Book of the Dead. Has he done any Tibetan research on their processes?
Oh, that's great. The sort of guidebook to the afterlife and heading there. Juanita, thanks. Sam Parnia, what about it? Have you looked there? And are these experiences that are reported culturally consistent, whether it's Eastern, Western Hemisphere, Tibetan mountains, wherever?
I think that's a very interesting question. As a general rule, I'm really concerned with trying to understand what happens to us when we die from a scientific point of view. There are obviously very many cultural, religious, philosophical views that have been expressed for thousands of years, probably before that, and we may not have any history of those. So my focus has really been on the science of what happens when we die, both in terms of the brain and also the mind. What we do know currently from small studies, and we need more studies to confirm this, is that essentially when you examine the experience that people have had across the world, many different cultures, the core features are very similar. So, for example, somebody who may be a Christian in the West and somebody who is a Hindu, let's say, in India, will both have a critical illness and come back and describe these experiences. And what they will say is that they felt peaceful, they saw a light, they saw a tunnel. They may describe seeing a being of light, a being that was very perfect for them and that they really enjoyed meeting. The Christian may then describe this person as being Jesus, and the Hindu may describe that they saw Krishna, or one of the Hindu deities. So it looks like the interpretation of what people see very much depends on their own cultural background, but the core features, by and large, are very similar. And of note, which is also very interesting, is that very, very small children have also described these experiences. I've had a number of cases from children where they had had this experience where they weren't even 3 years old yet. They were just under three. And interestingly, their experiences, the core features are very similar to what the adults say. But they're an interesting group because they're too young to have any concept of death or the afterlife or to have been essentially their thoughts to have been formed by mm-hmm. their social, cultural, religious mm-hmm. backgrounds. Mm-hmm. You know, they're just too young for that. So the experience seems to be very much universal.
These fascinating consistencies. You look in your book back in history all the way back to Plato's Republic, where the soldier has a near-fatal injury on the battlefield, revived in the funeral parlor, and describes journey from dark to light and a moment of judgment, feelings of peace and joy, visions of extraordinary beauty. And then you take it right on up through, you know, British sailors who were drowning and describe what happened when they came back. A Swiss geologist and mountaineer taking firsthand accounts from people in the mountains. The 15th century Dutch painter Hieronymus Bosch with his remarkable painting, which you have in the book, Ascent into the Empyrean, which looks like a kind of visual version of exactly what you're describing, up from the sort of tangle of life into this more serene tunnel toward light.
Yes, absolutely. These experiences have been described throughout history, and particularly for Hieronymus Bosch, I think it's fascinating, because if you think about the sort of the Christian view of death, say, that was prevalent in Europe in the 1400s, 1500s, around that time, it's actually very different. Even today, I would say, is very different to what people with near-death experiences describe. You know, people with near-death experiences describe seeing a tunnel, seeing a light, and what Bosch has drawn is essentially a tunnel with a very bright light at the end of it and people being taken towards that light. Now, who knows whether Bosch himself had a near-fatal accident, whether he had a near-death experience, whether somebody told him of their experience and therefore he decided to draw it. I'm not sure. But it's fascinating, and it shows that the experience has been universal, even though we in modern times have only been aware of it for the last, say, 30 years or so.
Well, it's amazing to think how far science can get into this. I feel a skepticism always at the back of my mind, and yet these stories and the consistency are there. Let's hear one now. Let's turn to Cedartown, Georgia, and Jerry Baldwin. He's 63 years old. He had a near-death experience on March 11th, 1991, when he was 47 and a half. Had a full cardiac arrest. EMTs said he was flatlined for 3.5 to 4 minutes. He's married, 5 children, 12 grandchildren, 8 grandchildren, great-grandchildren now. Jerry Baldwin, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate it being with you.
What happened when you died?
Well, I live in a small community, and I was at home, and I was feeling kind of, you know, I got feeling a little bad, and then as a smoker, you know, they always think you sit down and smoke a cigarette, it'll help you. So I sat down, and my wife came up about that time. She says, "You're real pale. I need to call Ems, carry you to the hospital." And I said, "No." But my mother passed away at 64 and a half, or mm-hmm. heart attack. So about that time, it felt like about 6 elephants got in the middle of my chest. And they wouldn't get off. And then I started to follow her in the house, and then it was just like somebody took a valve and cut my wind off, and I didn't have any, and I just hit the floor. Well, she called 911, and I got up, and I made it to the couch. And being a former medical lab technician, I put my feet up and got on the couch, put my feet up above my head to try to get the blood flowing back to my heart. But so about that time, the EMTs got here, and they come in, and they started to, and I said, "I think I'm having a heart attack." They started cutting my shirt off, started hooking me up. And I had this feeling come over, and I looked him straight in the eye and said, "I'm fixing to die. I'm fixing to leave you." And he said, "No." I said, "I'm gone." And about that time, if you've ever sat down on your foot in a chair or something, and then got up and your foot was asleep and just kind of tingly, my body started to feel like about 6 inches from my body that it was just like a real tingly all over. And then everything got kind of gray for a minute or two, and then it turned totally black. And about that time, I floated out of my body. I live in a 2-story, 5-bedroom, colonial-style brick home, and there was no top on the house anymore. It was totally gone.
You were looking down as if it weren't there.
Yeah, no, I was up above my body in the room there, but the whole top of the house wasn't there anymore. It was just gone.
Yeah.
And I started watching them work on me.
With the defibrillators and all,
defibrillators,
and all the paddles.
They drug me off the couch in the floor, and they took the defibrillators, and they shocked me once. That day, they said, "We can't get him." They shocked me the second time. And when they shocked me the second time, they had already called for backup. And they the second time they shocked me, the paddle shorted out. and they said, they won't work. So the other ambulance was turning in the driveway. Well, I seen the ambulance turn in the driveway. I seen who was driving the ambulance and all. There's not any windows on that side of the house. They came in. They had already beat me in the heart, give me shots, and putting syringes in my arms and everywhere. And all of a sudden, it just felt like that I thought, well, I didn't really care whether they got me back or not. I just floating around. I said, well, if y'all not going to do anything, then, I don't know. And all of a sudden, I seen a tunnel. And there was the brightest light the other end of it. It seemed like I just went through it head first about 100 miles an hour. And all of a sudden, I went out into that light. And like I heard you say earlier, there's not enough words in the English language to tell people the beauty and the peace that you have. It was just like a total peace and total love that you just don't. It's beyond words and understanding. And all of a sudden, I was in the middle of this light, and I heard a voice out of the middle of it. It says, "You got to go back. Your wife's not handling it." I says, "I don't want to go back. I'm at peace." And he said, "Well, look down, and you can see." Well, I could look down like over a balcony, and I could see her. She had totally lost it. I said, "Well, Lord, I think she can take care of herself. I'm just at peace. I want to go. I want to stay here."
Lord, so you assumed this was...
That's why my mind said that to me, mm-hmm. And I says, "I just don't want to go back." And he said, "Well, I'll show you what it looks like, but then you got to go back."
What looks like, Jerry?
He just says, "I'll show you what it looks like."
Okay.
And so to me, I assumed when I got through, I would call it heaven myself, because of what I seen. It was like he took me by the hand, and it was like he was in a big room, and it's like exclusive, but you could see 1,000 miles. And I seen the prettiest flowers and heard the prettiest music, and the water was so clear. I seen my mother and father, who had been deceased for 20-some-odd years. And I seen one fellow that I didn't know who he was. And he told me he loved me, but I could come back. And it took several years later before I found out who he was. About, matter of fact, 2 years ago when I was doing a family tree, for the children, and it was my grandfather, my daddy's daddy, who died 3 years before I was born. I'd never seen him before. And when I seen his picture, somebody gave me a picture of him. I'd never seen him before, or a picture. And my hair stood up on the back of my neck because it was him. But anyway, after that, and he says, "Now you got to go back." And he turned my hand loose, and all of a sudden I went back through that tunnel just as fast as I came. And all of a sudden I was back, and he says, the EMT said the first thing I said to him was, "I left you for a while, didn't I?" And he said, "Yeah, hang on with us." And I said, "I don't want to. I want to go back." But I didn't want to go back. I wanted to go. I didn't want to stay here. But then they told my wife and him not to get in a hurry, that I wouldn't live to get to the hospital. Well, I survived to get there. And 9 days later, they was trying to figure out what to do with me. So the doctor come in and says, "You probably won't make it off the table. We're going to have to do a heart cath to see what's going on with you." And they did. And I'd lost about 60% of the lower left side of my, 40% of the lower left side of my heart. I only got 60% functioning. And so.
But you made it, Jerry. You've got 12 grandchildren, 8 great-grandchildren. Yeah. Now, let me ask you just for a second, put on your toughest, most skeptical, scientific cap and ask yourself, did that all really literally happen? Or is it possible that, that's a kind of version of events that you know how powerful the human mind is, that your mind created once you snapped back into life?
Okay. For 9 years, I felt just what you did. And, I was afraid to tell anybody. I told 9 people who were terminally ill in 9 years.
Mm-hmm.
But first of all, let me tell you that I'm an elected official in the county. I'm serving my third term on the school board, on the Board of Education.
So you're saying you're not a wing nut?
So I don't think I'm a wing nut, but I thought that day in the CCU, when a nurse asked me, she said the EMTs had told her that I had a answer to a question she had that I could tell her. And she asked me before they carried me into the heart cast because she was afraid I might not make it. And she said, "Just listen to me a minute." She was in her 30s. She had lost her son, who was 8 years old, with brain tumor about 3 months before, and she wasn't handling well. And she said the EMTs said they knew that you had a near-death experience from what you said and how you acted, that you could tell me. Well, I just froze because I thought, well, they'll ship me up to the P-Wing just any minute now. I can't tell her. And so, but it was just like somebody slapped me upside the head. I said, "I'll send you back. Tell her." Well, this happened once a year for 9 years. And one of them was my sister, who passed away in 2000 with ovarian cancer at 57. So, and after that, I had never written anything in my life. I was in church one night. And I started trying. It changed my life. I have no fear of dying whatsoever.
Jerry, hold the thought. Sam Parnia, this feels, as we hear it through, sort of like the classic textbook story. The tunnel, the light, the voice, back he comes, the serenity, the cosmic vision. Is this what you're
Absolutely.
Looking for in your research, Sam?
Well, you see, this is really a typical experience that people can describe. What we're interested in is the bit where he mentioned how he was looking down from the balcony, that it felt like as if he was looking down from a balcony, or he could see the ambulance crew coming, he could see who came. They describe very specific details that, at least as far as we are told, really did happen. If that is the case, then obviously it suggests that the human mind and consciousness, as difficult as it may be for us from a scientific point of view to accept or answer how, can separate from the brain. And I think I'd like to say that the human mind or consciousness really is a mystery. And if we make assumptions about how it must work, we may end up finding that we were wrong. And I think we have to keep an open mind until we can either prove or disprove how these things happen.
Well, I wonder. I thought that was kind of a done deal. But Sam, Jerry, stand by. Let's take a call from Steve in Boston. Steve, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
All right.
I take issue with one of the things that the doctor said about the brain being the seat of the mind. I would think that if he wants to take the dualistic point of view, he has to explain all of the neuroimaging evidence, all of the, long-term potentiation, all of the other things that have shown to change with different mental events or different experiential events in an organism. And I'm just not sure this idea that there's this grand debate between dualism and materialism in the neuroscience community. It's very misleading.
So what do you think then, Steve, about these accounts of near-death experiences? Sam says, look right there, and you may find the difficulty for those who don't see a dualistic image
right.
of mind and brain.
Well, again, I think the scientific community has weighed in on this in the memory literature. Mm-hmm. Cognitive psychology has already shown that memories are very, just looking at what somebody has to say as far as what they've remembered, it can be very misleading. Look at any sort of, Elizabeth Loftus's research. Look at people who think they've been abducted by aliens. These people really believe that. I don't question that. But if you look at, like, in England, for instance, people used to report Nordic-looking aliens. When the book Communion came out, 80% of people went from 80% saying they're Nordic aliens to 80% saying they're the gray aliens, the ones that we find more common now.
And what if those who come back from near-death experiences can describe to you that, I don't know, the tic-tac-toe board at the head of the bed that they could not have seen? Would it change your mind?
Well, I mean, sure. I mean, there's empirical evidence that could show something like that. Personally, I think the experiment, I don't know how much it costs, but it seems like a waste of resources. And if this experiment were done correctly and in no way was somebody in there leading the subject on say, oh, yeah, I know what was above the bed. I mean, if it's really done correctly, I mean, I bet anything that it's not going to work, but, of course, it's an empirical question. But as far as science builds on itself, and to ignore all of the memory literature, all of the cognitive neuroscience literature, and to sort of go it alone, picking up in the, 1600s or whatever, I just think is sort of a mistaken way to go about answering this question.
Steve, I'm very glad for your call. Sam, we've just got half a minute here. Do you run into that skepticism every time you walk out the
lab
actually door?
I actually appreciate Steve's comments. I think in 10 seconds, if I can respond to it, I wish you'd called earlier. All the evidence that we have shows that brain cells are involved and mediate thought processes. But like I explained, we have no evidence so far that demonstrates how brain cells can generate thoughts. And I think our experiment needs to be done to determine how things work. And that's what we're trying to do. We have to keep an open mind. And just finally, all the images are different and nobody knows what those images are going to be. And therefore, it is completely blinded.
Well, thanks for that. Jerry Baldwin in Cedartown, Georgia. We're glad you came back. Thanks for your story.
Thank you.
And Sam Parnia, author of What Happens When We Die, good luck with your research. We'll come back and see what you find on the other end. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.